Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I am Charlie Sykes. We have a very special guest. Daniel Krauthammer, the only son of Charles Krauthammer, is joining me here in studio. Thank you so much for coming in, Daniel.
No, thank you, Charlie, for having me. It's great to be here.
I want to talk about the book, the point of it all, but I also want to just talk about your father and the experience of putting this together. It's a collection of essays, but also a collection of your own recollections and the eulogy that you gave at your father's funeral. And I guess I wanted to just start off with something that really struck me about this book. The really close relationship you had with your father. Not everyone has that kind of relationship. You're an only child. I'm an only child. It really did strike me that there was something. Well, you just tell me about that. What was it like growing up with Charles Krauthammer as your dad?
Yeah, we were very close. Had a wonderful relationship. And it's something, as you point out, I think part of that's being an only child, but part of it's just the luck of having a great dad. And it's something I knew my whole life growing up, but to be honest, you know, I think I realized all the more these last months, and it's something that many people, both close to me and close to my dad, and even people who didn't know us personally that well, finally said out loud to me things I hadn't said in forever of how much they saw that our whole lives, of how close we were and how we got along, how many shared interests we had, how much we just enjoyed each other's company, and how much we'd like to talk about the same things intellectually and in terms of fun things and movies and everything in between. So it was a pretty rare and precious gift to be that close.
You were the only person who wanted to speak at his funeral, which I thought was a singular act of trust and love, that you were the one person, because, of course, you could have had a lot of people show up at that funeral telling a lot of stories about your dad.
He put that specifically in his will, actually. It was quite probably the most difficult thing I ever had to do. Surely the most difficult thing I ever had to say out loud. It was a difficult decision, too, to put it in the book, actually, because obviously it's a very personal thing and something that I didn't want to lessen or cheapen by, you know, putting it out there too broadly. But at the same time, it was the best way I knew how to honor my dad and express everything that I thought about the incredible man he was.
Most of us know your dad, and I was telling you a story when I had met him, which we don't need to repeat, but, you know, most people have known him through his writing, through the columns, through his appearance on Fox News. So was that the dad, was that the Charles Krauthammer that you knew? Was there another side to him that you think, okay, you know, people didn't see this?
Yeah.
People knew the brilliant analyst, you know, the stylist, the person who would have always the trenchant quote on cable television. But what else?
There was certainly more. You know, when you have a few minutes on TV, you can't quite show every side of yourself. I think most people, as you say, got the kind of brilliant analyst side, the incisive thinker. And also, I think a lot of his humor came through, which I'm glad of, all the incredible dry wit.
Very dry.
Great one-liners. So that was 100% him. But I think maybe the thing that, as I've been asked this before and tried to think about it a lot, maybe the thing that people got to see the least of was just him being relaxed and fun and engaging with people, which is just how he loved to be. He was a very outwardly focused person. He was just curious about everything and everyone and loved to learn about any subject, whatever it was, and whatever anyone was up to, whether it was just an intern he just met or catching up with an old friend. And he also just loved so many of the kind of simple pleasures in life, you know, going to ball games people know about, but I don't think they know just quite how childlike his love of the game was. And he would just load up on hot dogs and just be happy as a camper. Or, you know, gumballs come to mind. It was his favorite thing in the world. If he ever saw a gumball machine, he would immediately buy one. It was just a rule. And, you know, we'd love doing things like going on long car trips or going to rinky-dink beach towns and, you know, walks on boardwalks and getting ice cream. And I don't know. He just took great pleasure in so many of the small things in life. And I think that's something that probably people didn't get a chance to see.
And all the stories that came forward about it, you know, his kindness and his concern, his interest in other people, as you've been describing, he never allowed his disability to define him. But I always have to wonder, how hard must it have been for a man that brilliant, that outgoing, that gregarious, to be confined in that wheelchair and have to rely upon the kindness of others? I have not even heard a single story of him being short-tempered or tired. Perhaps you have seen different sides of it. But how was he able to keep up that spirit under those circumstances?
It was just who he was. And he had, I think, an incredible willpower and also just deep sense of what life is and should be about. And, you know, there are difficulties, obviously, much more than kind of people know, mm-hmm. For, you know, living a life with that disability. But as you said, the most important thing was that he didn't let it define anything about his life, really. And that was something, I think he lived that example incredibly well for all of us, because everyone has something that they deal with. And one of the most profound things I ever heard him say on this subject, and he didn't talk about it a lot, especially publicly. It was actually an interview I hadn't seen till after he passed, actually, but when he was asked about it, he said, and I'm paraphrasing, but something like, look, everyone has their cross to bear, everyone. Some of those are more visible, like mine. Some are not so visible. Some are just burdens carried on the inside that no one knows about, that no one knows are there, but that everyone deals with something. Everyone has burdens and challenges. And, you know, the point of life is not being defined by those, not being defined by the slings and arrows that life throws your way, but rather overcoming that and defining yourself by how you overcome that and how you choose your own path and defining your own destiny. And I think that's an incredibly powerful example that he lived with no fanfare and never made a big deal of it, but I know spoke to so many people.
Tell me about your mother. Because you commented in the eulogy about the close relationship, and I got the sense that you had this very tight-knit family.
Yeah.
And that you were really his ultimate support network. So tell me about your mom.
Yeah. Well, we're very close, too. And the three of us, as you say, were really, you know, it was always the three of us. Like, that's just kind of, that defines my life more than anything else, I would say. And they had you know, a wonderful, incredibly close marriage and bond, profoundly close, I think. And they had tons of fun. All the kind of little joys I was talking about my dad enjoying, they loved doing together, all the little small things, going out to their beach house together, going on little trips, going to see movies, all their inside jokes. Yeah,
well,
she
must have been a formidable woman in her own right, though, in order to keep up with your dad.
Oh, for sure. And she kept him on the straight and narrow. You know, I think she kept him honest. He would often say, you know, when he would sometimes have to go to cocktail parties or make appearances at places with, let's say, you know, important people who are less than outstanding in their moral character. My mom would say, I'm not going to that. Are you kidding? Mm-hmm. No. And my dad said, well, all right. Well, one of us has to uphold the moral stature of this household. The other one has to, you know, beg for his meal at dinner. No, but she's an incredible woman and was a lawyer, is an artist. And she and my dad founded a nonprofit that revives and puts on concerts of classical Jewish music, and she's continuing all of that.
This is a point about the book that I hope people understand, that even though your dad's writing and his cable TV appearances, etc., were, you know, dealt with politics, there's a lot of other things that are not political in this book, including his deep interest and his passion for culture.
Yeah, it really covers the whole gamut, and there are those big issues of politics and the nature of democracy and America's role, but it, you know, he talks about baseball and chess and movies and medical ethics and his friendships and really kind of his philosophy of life and his Judaism, his faith, so many different aspects. And really, you know, the amazing thing to me in finishing the book and kind of tying it together was to see that something that covers so much, which on the surface you'd think, you know, how do all these different things fit together? Yeah. But they really are all tied together so much by this kind of deep underlying philosophy, these deep ideas about humility, about human nature, about kind of what it means to build a constructive politics, constructive society, constructive personal life, that makes it just something that can speak on individual topics, but all together with even more power.
What was his religious faith?
It was complicated and pretty subtle. He grew up in an Orthodox Jewish household, so he began his life very religious. But as he described it, he moved away from what one might call kind of a literal belief in literal truth of any of it. But he always held his Jewish identity, Jewish heritage, Jewish traditions very close to him, and it was a core part of who he was. And he knew it backwards and forwards better than anyone I know. And, you know, I think he had a real reverence both for the Jewish tradition and also the idea that there's something greater out there. He, you know, I think he often talked about that we should have, you know, real respect and reverence for our own uncertainty, our own inability now and probably ever to really know any of these deepest and most absolute truths. And so he had a sense that there was something greater, something transcendent was the word he often used. And he came to that both through his Jewish traditions and through thinking about the universe and the truly big picture of things.
Well, we got to point out you've put together a website.
His official website, charlescrowdhammer.com, was kind of in tandem with the book, something I made sure came to completion, and it has information about the book, but also lots of other resources about his life, archives of his work, tributes written to him. So a place I would really suggest anyone who's interested to learn more check out.
Well, as a writer, I often look at your father's columns with a certain level of despair because they are so well crafted, they are so thoughtful, and he had an unusual rule that he only wanted to write one a week because he didn't want to, you know, dilute what he was doing, which had to involve a good deal of restraint on his part because he obviously was a mind that was, you know, thinking and analyzing all the time. So could you give us some insight about why he decided only one a week?
Yeah, well, he decided that before I was born, so it predated me, but he talked about it. It actually talks about it in the book, too, in a couple columns, that to your point, he thought, you know, he really... You know, I think it sums up his whole approach to his career in a way that he was not just filling space. He wasn't just going through the motions. He felt if he was doing this for his life's work, it needed to have a real point. Everything he wrote, everything he said.
That's raising the bar on yourself.
It is. No, he had, unbelievably high standards for himself. But that's how he came to it. And I think in later years, he often told me one of the reasons he liked TV was that he could, in smaller bits, say all the little ideas he had.
I was going to follow up what it was for, because there are a lot of folks who would think, you know, if you're a you know, profound thinker, the last place you want to be is as a talking head on cable TV. Now, I do this as well, so what did he like about it?
He had a lot of fun.
He did have fun. You could tell that he enjoyed it.
Yeah. And, I mean, both hanging out there just with his friends and colleagues and being on the air. I think he used to say to me that I mean, he felt, and he writes this in the book too, he felt profoundly lucky and grateful to have ended up with the life he did. He said he felt he was doing what he was meant to do.
Really?
And, yeah. Mm-hmm. And one way he described that to me, I remember when he was younger, he said, you know, when I was a kid in school, I always loved that part of class where we talked about current events and we just argued about it. And like, that's basically what I do now.
And he gets so paid to do it.
And TV in particular, I think, is really was that for him. He got to, you know, talk about a wide variety of things and make his point, you know, quickly and on very well, but without the, you know, I think we're talking about his high standards. I think he kind of killed himself writing every column, so it was a little more relaxing and I think got around his own perfectionism by just he had to say it, didn't have a choice to edit it.
But I used to watch him all the time when he became a YouTube sensation, and he clearly went in prepared. He clearly knew what he wanted to do, and there was a sense that he had, if he had not written the column, that he had conceptualized what his answer was going to be, which is why. So it must have been an interesting transition to go from a somewhat well-known scribe to being a media figure who was recognized everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, interestingly, it happened fairly gradually, I would say, just because it, you know, kind of tracked my lifespan too. That he wrote his column and, you know, essays in magazines, and he did a weekly show which is on PBS and local stations in DC and other places for most of my childhood, and only started Fox in the 2000s, really, and then became more and more prominent. But you know, I think he was asked about this once of, you know, what is it like. You now realize so many people are watching you and hanging on your words. And he said, you know, it's kind of disconcerting. When I was younger and no one was listening, you know, I could say whatever I wanted. There wouldn't necessarily be an impact. But as, you know, he got older and he knew people really acted on what he said, I think he also had a real sense of responsibility to only say what he thought was true and would be good for the country.
Well, I did a radio talk show for many years, and every Friday when his columns would appear, was it Friday? With tricks of memory, we would always have a segment calling "Dropping the Crowd Hammer," you know, because we would be able to do all that. And then, of course, at one point, the President of the United States singled him out, and one of those I thought was defining moments, because you take one of the most intelligent, lucid, decent men, and what was it? What was it he said about him? I mean, it was just we were all dummies. We were all idiots. We all got that treatment, you know. But
I think there were a few back and forths. And my dad's favorite one was when his last book, Things That Matter, when it came out in the paperback edition. I think Trump tweeted something, and he said, you know, Krauthammer's Things That Matter out in paperback, book sucks. And my dad loved that. He said he wanted to get the publishers to put that as the only blurb on the back of the book. But there, you know, I think with Trump, he, you know, Trump called out my dad several times when my dad criticized him. There were, I think, one or two times when my dad wasn't necessarily defending Trump, but, you know, attacking some of the arguments against him at some point, and Trump said, "Even Krauthammer says this," and you know, so you know, I think as
he was in his head,
as the president often does, when you're for him, he likes you; when you're against him, he doesn't.
Yeah, I think that is the pattern.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you mentioned we started off by talking about the, you know, you're an only child; you were very, very close to your father. So, was there any moment you can remember when you realized that my dad is Charles Krauthammer? Do you understand what I'm getting at?
Yes, okay. Yeah. No, I do. I know what you're saying. I don't think there was ever a moment. I think it was probably gradual too. And even now, it's, you know, on the one hand, I'm obviously aware of that, but on the other hand, that's not how it is to me, you know, personally on the inside. He's my dad, and that was always and will always be the most important part. But I think it was, you know, as I got older and moved away from home and got some perspective and I think then I would realize his stature. And I think the thing that was really the marker for me was the incidence of how often, you know, checking at a hotel or TSA, they would recognize my last name. And that definitely went up over the years. So
I want to put this next thing in some context, because I was very close to my dad, and he died very suddenly when he was 63 years old. Mm-hmm. I never had the chance to say goodbye to him.
Yeah.
You had really, and I you know, reading your thing, you understand the incredible blessing of being there for that, to be able to, whatever unfinished business you had with your dad, to be able to say goodbye to him.
Yeah.
And over a long period of time, what was that like?
I'm very grateful for it. It was extremely difficult, on the one hand. You know, it was a 10-month hospitalization. I was, and my mom and I were both there with him that whole time. So without a doubt, the most difficult period of my life. But at the same time, I'm very grateful that I had that time to be with him, both to be there, you know, at the end, but also all the time in between, just the times we hung out and watched movies and everything else. That was just more time to have together.
And this book strikes me as sort of your last tribute. It's something that you had had you discussed this with him?
Yeah.
Prior, he knew.
Yeah. So the book, he had started it and been working on it for quite some time before his health crisis struck. And most of the book that you see now, he had chosen and put together. But there was still a lot to be done. And when he was in the hospital, I actually helped him to work on it, kind of jerry-rigged computers and such in his hospital room so he could continue to work on it. And that's where I got my sense of what he wanted to do with it, what his goals were. And when we learned the final prognosis and he knew that he wouldn't be able to finish it himself, that's when he entrusted it to me and asked me to finish it for him. And the last thing he said to me about it was, if it's not worthy, don't publish it. And I took that extremely seriously. And I, you know, this project for me of finishing the book and making sure it was done as best as could possibly be, and up to the incredibly high standards we talked about, was without a doubt the most meaningful and important project I've ever undertaken in my life.
Daniel Krauthammer, thanks so much for coming in here and talking about this with me.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Daily Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow.